Stories are very powerful. And speaking of stories, we tell stories about the economy all the time. And you write something. I wrote an article that I called "The Stock Market Is Not the Economy." And you write about it in your book.
Yeah, so this is probably the most powerful straight-up investing mental model I have in my book of the stock market is not the economy. And if you look at economic growth, so GDP growth in any given calendar year, and you compare it to what the stock market does, there's no correlation. Since World War II, it's basically zero. You can just go back to March of 2020, and the stock market bottom, it dropped nearly 35% from its high. The stock market bottom was on March 23rd. And on March 26th is when we had our 1,000th reported COVID death in the U.S. So like if you and I had a crystal ball and we were sitting there on March 23rd, mm-hmm. and the crystal ball didn't tell us what the stock market was going to do, but it was tell us what's going to happen in the real world. And said, guess what? This quarter, this coming quarter, GDP is going to contract by 8.9%. Right. Crazy. Uh-huh. I mean, that's breathtaking. Unemployment is going to spike to 14.7%, highest since Great Depression. Mm-hmm. We're going to have over 330,000 deaths in the U.S. by the end of the year, 6 million deaths globally over the next 3 years. And this isn't, well, we're going to like lock down for like a few weeks or months. This is going to go on for years. The NHL and the NBA are going to cancel their seasons. We can't travel internationally, even to Canada, and on and on and on. Like if we knew all those things, like I think most people would be like, I'm going to bury my money in the backyard. But March 23rd was the bottom.
Welcome to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. How to make it, save it, keep it. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question. What it means to live a rich life beyond money. My guests share their practices, principles, and evergreen wisdom. I'm your host, Bogumil Baranowski, author, TEDx speaker, investor, and a founding partner of Sicard Associates, a boutique investment firm founded in New York City. Join me on this quest to unearth the wisdom of the ages. Welcome, everyone. I'm so glad you're tuning into my podcast. For your convenience, the show is available on a multitude of platforms, including Spotify, Apple, Google, Audible, and many more. If you want to keep up with all new episodes, and there's so many more in the queue, make sure you subscribe and please do share it with friends and family. Review it and rate it if you can. Every little gesture matters, and I thank you for it. If you'd like to know more about me, or if you're interested in getting in touch, simply Google my name and it will lead you straight to my website. There's a contact form there, or check notes to this episode for links. I love hearing how you listen to my podcast on your walks, hikes, alone times, drives, trips, and more. I trust that my guests and I are a wonderful company on those adventures. I also enjoy reading how some of you are rehearsing and answering some questions that I ask my guests. I love hearing that. If you're new to the show, please scroll down and check out all the amazing guests I've had over the last few months. If you are serious about investing, money wisdom, wealth, and living a better life, you'll find plenty of episodes with some incredible ideas. For those who enjoy reading thoughtful pieces, I regularly write articles on Substack, which I'm sure you'd find insightful. Find me there and follow me as well. Finally, I'd like to mention my latest book, Crisis Investing. It's a collection of 100 essays that I penned for our clients during the tumultuous times of the global COVID pandemic. These essays are both timely and timeless, providing a unique perspective on navigating through crises. They were never meant to be published, but here they are available to you. Please find the book on Amazon. The book has already received considerable recognition and much love, ranking among the top releases on Amazon in its initial weeks. Thank you for your support and for being a part of my listener community. Now, without further ado, let's dive into today's episode. My guest today is John Jennings. He is president and chief strategist of St. Louis Trust and Family Office, a $15 billion wealth management firm. As an author and speaker, he's a leading voice in the space of wealth management and leadership. His book, The Uncertainty Solution, is an engaging dive into investing philosophy and best practices, as well as an authoritative, accessible guide for anyone who feels inundated with financial news and data. A must-have addition to anyone's reading list, according to Charles Schwab. Jennings is also the author of the highly acclaimed Interesting Fact of the Day blog. He's an adjunct professor at Washington University and frequently writes on wealth management topics for Forbes. He has finance and law degrees from the University of Missouri and a professional certificate in decision-making and behavioral finance from Harvard. Today, we touch on John's professional turning point, the financial crisis of 2008, and how it reshaped his identity and approach to investing. John shared a fascinating study about human behavior and how we prefer certainty over uncertainty, even if it implies discomfort, and how this principle applies to investing. We delve into the topic of information overload in investing. We explore the concept of past performance regression to the mean and the roles of luck and randomness in investing. John unpacked the difference between unknowable and the unknown in the world of investing. We discussed the human tendency to simplify complex situations into a single cause explanation. John shared an intriguing anecdote about diet choices and health, underscoring the importance of sample size in decision-making processes. John elaborated on his viewpoint that stock market is not the economy. John shared his belief that waiting for perceived safety and a healthy economy is not a profitable strategy, offering a contrarian perspective. We discussed the perils of predictions through stories of Alan Greenspan and a New York hedge fund manager, reinforcing the idea that predictions often fall short. John walked us through the 8 best behavior practices he outlines in the book. We concluded the interview with a reflection on success, inviting John to share his personal definition. Please help me welcome John Jennings. Well, hello, John. How are you? Nice to see you. Nice to meet you.
Great. Thanks. Nice to be seen.
Well, you know that I'm a big fan of your book. It's called The Uncertainty Solution, How to Invest with Confidence in the Face of the Unknown. And I took so many notes and I have so many questions for you. And it really resonated with the way we think at Seacard Associates. So we manage patient, disciplined kind of capital. And you have some very refreshing ideas and thoughts. And as you mentioned, you tell the truth. And I'll ask you more about it in a second. I like to start those conversations with the beginning, if you indulge me. And I like to ask my guests about their childhood and upbringing and how they think that this time has influenced their relationship with money and then led them to a career in investing.
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, which is where I live now. And so my father was a banker. Mm. And so, you know, we were one of those families that most dinners we had around the table with all 5 of us, me and my parents, my 2 brothers. And my dad always talked about, you know, the money world and the banking world. So I was very interested in that just because I found it fascinating. So when I went to college, I majored in finance. So that's really kind of how I got into it. It's kind of funny. I wanted to major in economics. My dad was like, what? You're going to be what? An economist? He's like, I'll tell you, we have economists at the bank and the rest of us all make fun of them. And I was like, why do you make fun of economists? And he's like, oh, they're always telling us what they think is going to happen and it never turns out, but they're really good at telling us how what happened was possible.
Very helpful.
He talked me. I took a lot of, you know, I practically had a double major in economics, but he's like, do something a little bit more useful like finance. And I went to law school. I practiced estate planning and tax law and a little bit of traffic law, right? Here in Missouri, it's a speeder's paradise. A lawyer can get you out of a moving violation. So I did that for, you know, a while. And then I was at Arthur Andersen. So we got back into investing at Arthur Andersen, but also the high-end tax planning, estate planning. Then, as many people know, maybe not younger people, but Andersen was one of the big 5 accounting firms.
Right.
But it went out of business in the wake of the Enron scandal, which it was embroiled in. And so then we started our current firm 21 years ago out of the ashes of Arthur Andersen. But the Andersen experience, while horrible at the time, ended up, you know, selfishly, you know, good for me personally. But, you know, it was a tragedy for many people. But it was this, you know, 90,000 employees. And, you know, a year before our firm started, it was like, you know, we were one of the top names in all of financial services. And then a year later, we are out of business. And that's really informed a lot of how I view the world. And randomness and chance and risk is really the failure of a, you know, nearly 100-year-old firm that had 90,000 employees where I worked.
I think Buffett says that it takes a lifetime to build up trust and reputation, and one day or one moment, and you can lose it. And in the financial services, that's the truth.
A few people in one office in Houston doing the wrong thing brought the entire firm down. I mean, there were other issues as well, but that was really the, you know, the catalyst.
Pretty crazy. Incredible. You mentioned in your book how you could divide your life between the time before the financial crisis of 08, 09, and after that. And you spent quite a bit of time explaining how you changed. You became a different person, a different professional. Yeah. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think everybody, you know, you have these seminal moments in your life. We have a lot of, you know, halves of our life, like, you know, becoming a parent or not. For me, seeing the movie The Matrix, I can divide my life as, you know, pre-Matrix and post-Matrix. But yeah, the financial crisis, you know, going into the financial crisis, like I knew so much, you know, I spent hours a day, you know, reading and researching the markets and the economy and, read all these, you know, newsletters from different investment analysts. And I knew a ton. I was a like walking encyclopedia of, you know, financial and economic information. And when the financial crisis happened, first of all, I didn't see it coming, which really shook me.
Right.
And obviously I wasn't alone. I mean, a few people, you know, shorted the mortgage market and things, but most everybody didn't see it coming. And then in the midst of it, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to advise my clients. I was, you know, fortunately, we didn't make any big moves. And basically we did a lot of nothing, which was really good in retrospect. But it was really because I was like deer in headlights. I didn't know what to do. But I had this coworker that when I went to meetings with her, she was just gave this really great, she was calming. She gave great advice. And she just said, you know, for all of our clients, you have plenty of cash, you have bonds, you know, this too shall pass. And I was like, wow, I need to be more like Liz, who really only kept lightly abreast of everything that was going on. I mean, she's very smart, CPA, you know, really, really great. But, you know, instead of spending these hours a day reading financial stuff, she maybe spent hours a month. And, you know, that was more than enough. And it gave her perspective. So I, in the wake of the financial crisis, I went on a quest for wisdom. So I realized that I was stuck down in, you know, data and information and drinking from the fire hose of news and data. And I needed to go on a quest for wisdom. And so really, I had a decades-long quest for wisdom. And this book is the result of what I found.
I like the sound of that. And you bring back some memories of 08, 09. So I was 3-4 years into my career at the time. So I was still a junior analyst, you could say. And I remember March of 2009, somebody invited me to a breakfast with the CFO of Tiffany's. And he was at the higher floor, top floor of the Rockefeller Center. And it was a foggy day. You couldn't really see down. I was hoping I'm going to see a lot of New York. And nobody, hardly anybody showed up to this meeting. I think it was me, one more analyst, and whoever the salesperson was from one of the investment banks. And I thought, if nobody wants to talk to the CFO of Tiffany's, I think this must be close to some sort of a bottom.
Wow. And like if you know, if everybody had just plowed money into Tiffany's right then and there, luxury has done amazing.
Of course.
Just amazing.
Of course. Yeah. But if anything, at the same time, I also went to an idea dinner in New York where people went around the room and they pitched their best idea. And everybody around the room, no joke, was saying, buy U.S. treasuries, buy U.S. treasuries, buy U.S. treasuries. And one or two people had a stock idea. It wasn't a fixed income dinner. It was meant to be a stock idea dinner. Yeah. But I think it was an indication of, I think we're close to some sort of a bottom. Yeah. You have a fascinating quote idea in your book when you talk about uncertainty and a study that I'll ask you to share where you say how humans hate uncertainty. We prefer certainty even if it comes with pain. And you talk about the study where if you know that the pain is going to come, you prefer that than not knowing if it's going to come or not. Can you talk about that? I think it's a powerful idea.
Yeah. If you think about what uncertainty is, at its root, it's our ability, our inability to spot a pattern. So we've evolved as a species to be these pattern recognizing machines because it gave us a survival advantage. I mean, you're living a few hundred thousand years ago as a, you know, an early human, your ability to spot weather and seasonal patterns, you know, migration patterns of prey, are those berries nutritious or poisonous, et cetera, you know, gave you a survival advantage. So our ancestors that were better at spotting patterns had a survival advantage, reproduced more, and we are their descendants, right? So physiologically, what happens is when we can't see a pattern, we become worried or anxious, or even it can trigger our fight or flight response. And when we resolve that uncertainty, it's relaxing. The opposite effect kicks in. The sympathetic nervous system kicks in and we relax and We even get a dose of dopamine, which is pleasurable. So we have this complex relationship with uncertainty where we dislike it, but we love resolving it. So a little uncertainty can be exciting. So like if you don't know the end of a movie or a book, that can be exciting, or watching a sporting event. Like if you're one of those people that like, if you don't get to watch your sporting event, you've recorded it and you're like, no one tell me the answer, right? No one tell me who won, right? So there's that. And that's why some people like to gamble. It's because they have a little bit of non-threatening uncertainty and then they resolve it, right? So this idea that we dislike uncertainty and we seek to resolve it is actually what's known as one of the primary human motives. So it underpins so much of our behavior and our decision-making, and we don't even realize it because it's largely subconscious. But the study you referred to, which is actually chapter one of my book, this is like how the chapter starts, is there was this study that was done at University College London that's just fascinating, where they gathered 45 volunteers and they had them play a video game. And while they're playing the video game, they had a sort of bracelet thing around the wrist that would give them a painful electric shock. Like it wasn't, you know, debilitating, but you definitely didn't want to be shocked, right? And the game is they turned over virtual rocks, and if below the rock there was a snake, they got shocked. So at the beginning of the game, only one certain type of rock had snakes. So very quickly they figured out not to turn over that rock. Then there was another, then the game progressed and where the snakes were distributed randomly. So they were shocked about 50% of the time, but there was no pattern. They couldn't find a pattern and they were shocked 50% of the time. But then the game progressed again. So under part three of the game, they got shocked every time they turned over a rock. So they had 100% certainty. They just were like, I'm going to get shocked. So that's pretty interesting to shock volunteers while they're playing a video game. But that wasn't the point. It wasn't really the point of the game. The point of the game was they measured their stress levels. So their respiration, their pulse rate, their blood pressure. They actually even sampled their cortisol, which is a stress hormone. They did that periodically. Then they asked them, how stressed are you feeling? And what they found is when they could spot the pattern and avoid the pain in the beginning, they had low stress.
Right.
And predictably, when the pain was randomly distributed, super high stress, it totally spiked. But part three of the game was interesting. The stress level where there was certain pain was nearly as low as it was when they could have certain avoid the pain. So it goes like this. Certainty, avoid pain, low stress. Uncertainty, 50% pain, high stress. Certainty, 100% pain, low stress again. So what happens is, and you can think about like if you were playing this game, if you didn't know if you're going to be shocked,
right?
Like every time you turn over a rock, you'd be like, oh my gosh, like you'd feel the stress. But if you just knew you're going to be shocked every single time, even if it was painful, you'd just steel yourself against it. And this sort of result has been replicated over and over in different types of studies that show that we would prefer certainty, pattern recognition, even if it's more unpleasant. So there's another study looking at bosses. People would prefer a kind of like unpleasant, unfair boss all the time than one that's sporadically unfair. And I've lived that. As a young lawyer, I worked with a lawyer, let's call him Jim, because that was his name. And like, I didn't know what I was going to get. Every day I'd come in, I'm like, I'm going to get good Jim, or, you know, am I going to get bad Jim? And like, you'd come in and I'd talk to like the other associates and like paralegals, like, what is Jim like today? And it was unbelievably stressful, where I've worked for difficult bosses. I'm like, that's just how they are. So again, we prefer patterns, even if it's unpleasant to, in general, compared to not being able to spot a pattern.
So I think the lesson for investors would be, there might be losses, there might be paper losses, and there might be times when you live in a deeper drawdown, and it's just part of it. And I think embracing it, it's helpful instead of thinking it's always going to be good and better and better. I think the disappointment can be too overwhelming for some people. You point out something really interesting. Investment profession is tricky because picking the best manager of last year is not a good recipe. And you talk about the past performance, the regression to the mean and luck and randomness. Can you talk more about it? In many other pursuits, just picking the best from last year should serve you well. Yeah. But here, it's not always the case.
Yeah. And let me divide this a little bit. So first of all, let me say that I'm going to talk about investment managers that pick publicly traded stocks.
Right.
It's a bit different in private investments. But with publicly traded stocks, there's almost no persistence in investment manager performance. And what's meant by persistence is that if in one period their performance tells you what's going to happen in the next period. Whether you're looking at, you know, quarters or years or even, you know, 5 or 10 year periods, there's almost no persistence. There's a little bit, but there's almost no persistence. So for example, there was a study that was done by the Wall Street Journal. It's pretty easy to do. And they looked at the Morningstar star rating. So their highest rated funds have a 5-star and the lowest rated have a 1-star. And they found that a 1-star manager was more likely to be a 5-star manager in the next period than a 5-star manager was. So,
interesting.
So in other words, you know, this is the power of the regression to the mean. And it just shows that there's a lot of randomness and luck in investing in public stocks. And that is just absolutely the case. So you're almost better off picking a manager that is underperforming mm-hmm. than one that is outperforming. You know, the odds are better with you because regression to the mean would say that that manager that's really a poor performer is going to do better. And I tell a story in my book, and this is a true story. So all the stories in my book are true.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes I change the facts a bit to protect people, and I absolutely change the names. But
of course.
So earlier in our firm, you know, we were probably about 5 years old. There was this young, just brilliant investment analyst that worked at our firm. And he decided to leave to go to a huge financial institution. And at his exit interview, I asked him, we'll call him Dave, not his name. But I said, Dave, why are you wanting to leave? And he said, you know, I don't feel like I'm really given the reins enough here to pick outperforming investment managers. I feel like I'm too much in a process. You know, we use investment consultants and, you know, and we're indexing too much. So, you know, I think we, you know, I really want to be able to spread my wings more. And I'm going to be able to at this other firm. And I said, well, let's have a little bet. I know you're leaving, but let's have a bet. Let's each pick 3 investment managers, you know, a domestic, an international, and then a bond manager. And in 3 years, whoever has done better, let's do a $100 bet. He said, great. So he spent like 2 of his 14 days left at our firm, like doing all this research, and it could be anybody. And he came up with these 3 managers. I forget what they were. But at the time, we were using an investment consultant, and I just picked 3 managers off their watch list, meaning they were underperforming. Had no idea who they were. Didn't even open the research. I was just like, if they're on the watch list, I will pick them. And at the end of 3 years, I beat him, and it wasn't even close. Like, mm-hmm. I crushed him. And to his credit, I forgot about this bet. And 3 years later, he sends me an email, you won, and he mailed me a check. I mean, it was kind of pre-Venmo days, right? And I really have a lot of respect for that. And because of that, I didn't cash the check and I kept it in my office for a while. But all I did was say, I'm going to use regression to the mean, where he, you know, was picking these managers that had really strong, you know, performance. And I hope that he learned from that. And I hope he's had great career success, you know, picking managers after, you know, being reminded of regression to the mean. You know, he was a CFA. He'd learned about regression to the mean. He had just forgotten how to apply it. And I think he thought he could spot patterns where none existed is really why I think he thought he could do a better job of picking investment managers than we were currently doing.
And what you are talking about is being the best in your respective category in a particular period of time when you talk about persistence, right? So being again, number one, number one, number one. And the point that you're making and what I'm hearing is that staying that number one is very hard or almost impossible.
Almost impossible. In fact, you know, managers that over long periods of time, you know, 15, 20 years outperform always go through, you know, these really tough years. In fact, there was a study by Vanguard looking at, they looked at 1,500 and something equity mutual funds, and they found that only 18% of them survived and outperformed. So over a 15-year period, that's pretty similar to other, you know, other studies. But what they found is that the vast majority of them underperformed, like something like 95% of them underperformed at least 5 years.
It's a long period of time when you have capital that's not very sticky and very loyal, that will not wait.
And over 60% had 3 consecutive years of underperformance. So you can imagine how hard that'd be to stick with. But real quick, let me distinguish between, you know, public stock managers and private investments. So private equity and venture capital, there is persistence. Now, it's not 100%. If you look at, you know, all private investment managers kind of together that report, if you look like a, you know, like a PitchBook data, you get to where a top quartile performing, you know, private equity or venture capital or private real estate manager has about a 30% chance of being a top quartile the following period. Mm-hmm. And another 30 or 40% chance of being in the top half. So in the second quartile as well. So it's not perfect, but that is much higher, much, much higher persistence than with private or with public equity managers, which shows you if you can get access to the top performing managers, you do have pretty good odds that you will do well, you know, over time with private investment managers.
Do you think it has something to do with the daily price quote that's available in the public markets?
Well, you know, I do, because I think the amazing thing about these private managers is you're locked up. I mean, they're 10-year terms typically, usually can be extended for another 4 years. So, you know, you're looking at 14 years and sometimes, you know, they're stragglers. So imagine how a public stock investor would invest differently if they had a 10 to 15 year lockup. And they didn't have to worry about their 3 years of consecutive underperformance or their 5 or 6 or 7 years of, you know, sporadic underperformance. They just did what they knew was right. You know, I think that you'd go from most managers underperforming to a lot of them outperforming, because I think there are ways. In fact, I know there are ways to outperform the market. The problem is the behavior of either the investment manager or the investor. It's the client that will pull money.
Right.
And we've used investment managers that were incredibly strong, and then they went through a period of underperformance, and they either changed what they did, thus sealing their fate, or you know, we've seen some that just went out of business. They had too many. Their underperformance caused, you know, clients to pull money out, and they kind of went down the tubes. So it's really hard as an investment manager to stick with what you think is right, because you will be out of favor a lot.
So when I'm thinking about the daily quote, you know, it creates amazing buying opportunities if you're in the public markets, because you have sell-offs in individual stocks and sectors and the whole market. Now, I remember studies, and you might be familiar with them, when the public comps would be down 50%, but in the private market, they were not priced down yet. They were down 5%, right? So on paper, it looks like, oh, in the private market, I wouldn't have lost the money. Right. Well, it's just the loss hasn't been realized. That's there's a delay in it, because at the end of the day, the exits from the private market go into the public market one way or the other, or at least use the valuations of the public market if it's a peer buying a peer. But at the end of the day, if the valuations for the peers went down in the public market 50%, the private market eventually will reflect that.
Well, I mean, that assumes that the price in the public markets is accurately reflecting the value of the companies are. And so in general, I agree. So if you see, you know, in 2022, the stock market down about 20%, and, you know, we weren't seeing private equity marks that were down 20%. So on one hand, I look at that and go, well, that's not really real. But on the other hand, I think there's some credence to how they are doing the marks. They're saying, you know, we don't really care.
Right.
What the market is right now, you know, we're, you know, unless we see it, you know, if they're saying, okay, you know, this particular company is, you know, 4x revenues and 11x EBITDA, you know, and that's kind of the market, you know, if they change the mark based on, you know, we've seen that those sort of multiples are changing, but just to say, well, the market is down, I can see why you wouldn't put in necessarily a market. And one reason I'm more sympathetic to this is, like, I look at our own company. So we're privately held. We're majority owned by clients, but, you know, we have a valuation formula, and so it's pretty steady. I mean, it does go up and down, but, like, our value, even though the stock market was down, our revenues were down a bit last year, it's not like our value was way down. And I kind of believe that, like, as a going concern, not a lot changed, even though a publicly traded peer would have been down a lot more than our valuation is. I mean, if we went to sell our company, you know, I feel good about our valuation, and we would have gotten what we would have gotten, even though in the public market, it would have been, you know, a lot more volatile.
I think there's also the psychological element to it. For people to see in the public markets that their portfolio is down 30%, it's a very tricky place to be. And especially with newer clients, we like to say that it's good to live with them through both a downturn and an overheated bull market, just to see how we really all react to it.
Yeah,
and I think the benefit of the private market is that you don't get the price quote in that moment. So you don't really have the pain, at least, you know, paper pain. And but in the public market, you have the advantage of going in and buying something at a 20-year low, like we did in March in 2020. That wasn't really as available in the private market.
No, it really wasn't.
There were not too many eager sellers in that market. But
no, there really weren't.
One last thought about the persistence. I think what's my lesson is that you don't really have to pick the top one, number one portfolio manager to do well. If you find somebody that does, on average, pretty fine, has respectable returns over very long periods of time without taking some unacceptable risks and having some blow-ups, you'll do just fine. And I think that gets lost because people think they have to pick the top every single time. That's not really the path to success.
Well, it reminds me, I was really into the triathlons in my 30s and up until my early 40s. So I was like a decent swimmer. I didn't swim in college, but I can swim decently. I was decent on the bike and I was decent on the run. Mm. But I definitely, I was not a top quartile in any of the three. I was probably a little bit above median in all three. But yet I often was top quartile in triathlons. And it's because I was decent in all three. And you had these situations where you'd have a great runner that just couldn't swim at all, or a great swimmer that just really struggled with the biking or the running and so on. And that just by being this kind of median performer in all three, I was top quartile as a whole, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's true of investment managers. You can have managers that, kind of year to year look sort of unremarkable, that over longer periods of time can do really well. But on the flip side, you can have managers that are just all over the place. They're, top decile and bottom decile and top decile, bottom decile. And it, those are definitely ones that are tougher to stick with. But we've seen managers do that are highly concentrated, that deliver, nice returns over time, but it's almost impossible to stick with them.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Have you heard of the term ergodicity and Luca Dallana?
Oh, yeah.
You have.
I really have. Yeah, yeah.
And he shares the idea that it's not the fastest skier, but the one that makes it to the end of all the races without breaking a leg. And I think that's what applies to in a lot of other pursuits, including investing. Yeah. You don't have to be the best manager this year, but the one that will be around for the next.
But I actually write about that concept in an article I published in Forbes about dollar cost averaging.
Uh-huh.
Like, what do you do if you get a big chunk of cash in? I'm not talking about just investing, part of your paycheck every month or your bonus or whatever, but we work a lot. So basically we mainly work in the $50 to $500 million range. So it's a lot of times they're families that have sold their family business that they've owned for decades or generations, right? And the question is should we invest it all at once?
Yep.
Or should we invest it over, 6, 9, 12, 18 months, right? And what the research says is that on average, you should just invest it all at once. And the real simple way to think about it is the stock market goes up about 2/3 of the time, regardless of what else has happened, in terms of calendar year. So if the stock market generally goes up, you should invest all at once. And I hear other advisors say, oh, you should invest all at once. And I'm not saying you shouldn't, but the thing to take into account is it doesn't matter what happens on average.
Right.
It matters what happens to you. So it's almost like if you were playing Russian roulette and you said, okay, 5/6 of the time on average, you're going to be fine.
Right.
So yeah, go ahead. Like if somebody offered you, $10 million to play Russian roulette, you'd be like, okay, you take, 5/6 times your $10 million and, it's this real positive thing. Mm-hmm. But the downside is bad. And if the 1/6 happens to you, you're like, wow. So most of our client families that have sold their businesses, they get this probably one big bite at the apple, decide to do it over time, knowing that mathematically, they probably should have done it all at once. Mm. But it's this whole concept you're just talking about that tells you that you've got to survive first for it to matter, right?
And that's a conversation that we have a lot with new clients. I call it the sudden wealth moment. So they had a business or they inherited a substantial wealth, and then there are some decisions that have to be made. And it's a question, do we do all of this at once and allocate it all, or do we do it over time? Our experience showed us that it's better to do it over time, just the way you explained it. Because, it took a while for the family to build this business, right? So there's no rush to be in all those assets and markets on day one. And you have some benefit that you mentioned. If you give yourself the 6 or 12 months or even longer, whatever the ongoing conversation is, I think the hardest thing is to go all the way in and experience a 30% drawdown. Oh, so it's beyond averages, beyond numbers. It's a human experience.
It is.
And sitting down with people, with clients, and actually explaining what happened. So we give ourselves the time to go in slowly. And I think it has paid off, even if not in terms of, you know, metrics. I think it has paid off in terms of earning trust and confidence of the client. I think that's how I look at it. You share a concept of unknown and unknowable. And I really like it because I think in the investment profession, there are quite a few people that want to pursue perfection. They want to know everything. They have to have, I think there's this expression, and I've heard more than once as a junior analyst, no stone unturned mindset. You know, you would do all the research, you would look everything up, and then somebody in the room would say, have we checked everything? Have we turned all the stones? And that's an impossible question because there's always one more thing to look at. And distinguishing between what's unknown and what's really unknowable, I think that's very helpful and it doesn't get you stuck.
Yeah. So it kind of goes back to, you know, a lot of people have heard Donald Rumsfeld, who used to, of course, be the Secretary of Defense. You know, he had this moment early, you know, 2003, talking about Iraq, that you have the known knowns, the known unknowns, and the unknown unknowns. So that's one way to think about it. I prefer just to call it the known, the unknown, and the unknowable. And
Right. Well,
one of the things we do when we can't spot a pattern and we feel uncertain is we become often information junkies, right?
Yes.
And, you know, I did this in 08, 09. I think a lot of us did it during COVID, where we spent all this time and effort trying to figure out what was going to happen, you know, when COVID was first spreading. And we feel better when we take in information. We actually get a little hit of dopamine when we have more information. And that can be really useful. If something is just unknown, but you can move it to the known, you know, that's amazing, right? And there's all sort of things in life that are just unknown, that if you just go and gather information, you can move it to the known. And So a great example is history. So, you know, we could debate about, you know, history's written by the winners and, you know, is really our version of history correct? But in general, things that have happened in the past, you can go, if you don't know about them, you can move to the known. And, you know, there's other things and patterns, but there's a lot of things that are unknowable. And knowing the difference between something that is unknown, but potentially knowable, and unknowable, which are things in the future, you know, that don't necessarily follow a set timing or pattern, you know, you're just spinning your wheels. And there's this phenomenon in the financial services industry where you get people all the time that know a ton of information about what's happened in the past or the news, what's only happening.
Right.
And they take this information and then they try to tell you what's going to happen in the future on areas that are unknowable. And I'll give you an example. I was just meeting with one of my coworkers yesterday who attended an investment conference that was put on by a huge broker dealer. Uh-huh. And they had, the broker dealer had these investment experts that were talking. And, you know, this one investment expert did, you know, great speaker, put on this great presentation, had all these slides of all these things. And my coworker was talking to him. And of course, you know, my book's about our investment philosophy, so he knows it. And he's read my book twice. So he went and he talked to this guy at like cocktail hour. And he was just like, you're talking about all these things in the economy and what's going on and everything. But it really doesn't tell you what's going to happen in the future. And this guy goes, I know, right? He goes, but for some reason, this is what all you people want to hear.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
And I think there's this transference. Like if somebody knows a lot of stuff, then you think that they're going to be able to tell you about what's going to happen in the future, which makes you feel better, which is why we like to listen to experts and expert opinions. But I think it's incumbent upon us to think about, you know, is what they're telling us something that's unknowable? Like I just read this morning that they see a possible, you know, best case scenario of the S&P 500 ending at 4,500 at the end of the year. But if we tip into recession, the downside case is being down 26%. Like that is ridiculous.
Very precise.
Like that is ridiculous. like and then they're selling their book here, like they're in their book, meaning, you know, what they want to have, you know, what they want to sell.
I think it's a bigger lesson there that you have to realize what is being sold to you. And you know, we're on the buy side. We buy stakes in companies for our clients, we buy the same ones for ourselves. We are really on the buying side of things. But if you have somebody that's selling something, whatever they share with you, whatever prediction they share with you, it's always curious to see what are you selling at the end of the day? And that will explain to you what kind of prediction you're going to end up hearing. I think that's confusing for a lot of people, but good to know. Speaking of experts, I really like this remark that you had in your book, how we have this appetite for single cause explanations. And whenever there are moments of uncertainty, we just want somebody on TV that will tell us it's the Fed rates. It's inflation. It's the unemployment. It's China. Tell us just one reason why this is good or bad.
Yeah.
Tell me more about that.
So again, with our dislike of uncertainty and really our quest for certainty, again, this is our the underlying, primary human motive. We want the world to make sense. So we are constantly looking for patterns and then seeking explanations. Like, we feel better when there's an explanation for something. And think about this. So say you hear about a friend or an acquaintance, and, let's say you hear that they have lung cancer. And you're like, that really sucks. I really feel bad for them. But like, one of the first questions you ask is, are they a smoker? And if they're a smoker and you're not, you're like, okay, I feel good. Like, there's an explanation for their disease and I'm not doing that, so it's going to be okay. But if you see, no, they're not a smoker. They've never smoked and they have lung cancer. Like, your uncertainty, like how you feel about that just completely spikes. You're like, there is no explanation for why they have cancer, lung cancer. Right. They just got it. And you may be like, well, did they live, in a polluted area or next to a power plant? Did their parents smoke? Did their grandparents smoke? Did they have radon in their home? Like, you're scanning around looking for an answer because we want the world to make sense. We want to have a cause and explanation. And the same is true in the stock market. And the answer of, the stock market's this really complex social system where you have millions of people and firms buying and selling tons of stocks every day.
Yeah.
And every single buy or sell has some sort of reason in it. And not all of it is what's going on in the market at the moment, right? And yet you'll see this headline, about, disappointing retailer earnings caused this, the S&P 500 to drop 1%. Or, concerns about the Ukrainian war does this or that. Like, that there's this single thing that is explaining this incredibly complex, unpredictable social system, which is the stock market, but it makes us feel better. And I get it all the time. Clients will go, why did the stock market do what it did today or this month? And really the answer is, it's too complex for us to ascribe a single cause to it, which is incredibly unsatisfying. And I know this because I say those sort of things to clients, and I'm sure they're thinking, like, we're paying you how much money?
You should know this. You should give us a simple answer.
I feel like my clients pay us a lot of money for me to say, and others at our firm to say, I don't know a lot.
And they still keep you.
Yeah, they do. They still keep us.
You just tell the truth. The other observation you made that I really liked, and I think applies to investors of all kind, is the sample size. And you tell a story of somebody having lunch with you. I know you're vegan, plant-based, so am I, and my wife, actually, so we can talk more about it. Right. We enjoy this path of discovery. But tell me that story about lunch. Somebody shared with them what kind of diet you're on.
So I've been a vegan since 2002, and probably like 2004. I went to lunch with a professional colleague, not at my firm. And so I do my order, which is kind of weird, especially back in like 2004, right? It's easier to order vegan. People know what vegan is now. But at the time, like, waiters and stuff didn't know what vegan is. So I'd be like, okay, I want you to bring me a salad, but I want no meat and no cheese, And I was asking other questions about, other parts of the meal, and the bread came and it had like some cheese baked in it. And I'm like, I'm not going to eat that, right? And so this person at lunch was like, why are you eating like that? And I'm like, I'm vegan. I don't eat animals. And he's like, oh, are you doing that because you're trying to save the animals? I'm like, I feel good about like not eating animals, but I'm doing it primarily for my own health purposes. Right. He's like, well, that is ridiculous. He's like, my grandfather lived to age 102 and he ate bacon every day. He drank whole milk. He basically was like the early version of the Atkins diet. If people know what that is, before people knew about it. And he lived to 102. And then we have this family friend who just died, and she was only 60 and she was a vegetarian. So what you're doing doesn't make any sense. You should just go ahead and enjoy your meat. And I didn't really argue. And I didn't say, well, I don't enjoy meat. I actually have like nightmares about if I were sent to prison, that I couldn't be a vegan anymore. So like, I have no desire to eat meat. But, again, his sample size is incredibly small. And this is how we operate as humans, is stories. I have an entire section in my book on this.
Right.
How stories have this outsized sway on how we view the world. And again, we've evolved, one of our killer apps and how we've, survived and thrived and dominated the planet for better or worse as a species is our ability to work in groups. And, there's other animals, mammals that'll hunt together and work in groups, but you're talking like a few of them. I mean, the fact that we can have nations of hundreds of millions or billions of people, and you can have people like when I worked at Arthur Andersen, 90,000 of us working towards a common goal,
right,
is just extraordinary. And one reason that we can do that is because we are storytellers. We can believe in things that are fictitious or abstract. Like, we can believe in nations and companies and sporting teams and things like that. You can have people that give their lives for their country, this idea. I mean, it's just amazing if you think about it. So we've evolved to pay particular attention to these stories, because again, people that could have a common shared story were more part of a group and then had a survival advantage. And again, we are their descendants. So I talk about the study in my book, which is one of the most mind-blowing things I've ever read. And in the study, they brought in volunteers and they said, you have a fictitious disease. And again, they told them it was fictitious. And basically, it's a parasite that, left untreated, will kill you within 2 years. Hmm. And we're going to give you an option of two drugs. And one drug is 50% effective. So we don't, it's a coin flip of whether it will cure you. Then on the second drug, they changed for each of the volunteers the variability. And so let's say, on one of them, they said there's the second drug. Drug B is 90% effective. So if you stop there, and like, if you're given the choice, like, you have a disease, it will kill you left untreated. One drug based on trials is 50% effective. One's 90% effective. I think everybody would pick the 90% effective. But what they did was amazing. For the 50% effective drug, they told them a story about a single patient that was neutral. They said, Chris has taken the drug. A few months in, it's unclear whether it has been effective. He has good days and bad days. We don't know whether it's going to be effective. But for the 90% effective drug, they would tell a positive or a negative story. And the negative story went like this. Pat has taken drug B.
Uh-huh.
A few months in, it is not working. She is blind and can no longer walk. It looks like she's going to die. So based on hearing those two stories,
right,
only 39% of people pick the 90% effective drug.
Wow.
61% still picked the 50% drug because of one single story. And then they changed, and they found the same thing when they changed all the, the different, percentages are on the effectiveness of drug B. That is incredibly telling how a single story can completely counteract what's known as the base rate. And that happens all the time in investing, where, we're constantly being told stories, even if they are not presented as stories. So whenever you look at investing in a stock, the company has a story. You're looking to invest with an investment manager, whether public or private. They have a story about what they do, who they are, and why they're going to outperform. Mm-hmm. And then it happens all the time in our daily lives. So my youngest daughter is about to leave to go study abroad in Tasmania.
Wow.
Which is an island off the coast of Australia, for those not totally up on their geography. So kind of bizarre. But, this past semester, while she was off in school, she goes to school in Maine, she needed her passport. And my wife rightfully said, I'm concerned about sending her passport, because if it gets lost, she won't get a new one maybe in time to leave for Australia. She needed the passport to, do the visa and everything. And she said, I just saw this story on, Facebook or Twitter or something, of somebody that had an incredibly important document had to do with adopting a child, and, FedEx or UPS or whatever, they lost the document, and like, they weren't able to adopt this child. Basically, it was like horribly tragic, like a horrible story.
Right.
And both of us were like, oh yeah, we're not going to FedEx this,
No.
We're not going to FedEx it. She's going to be home in a few weeks for spring break. We'll just, we'll slow down the timeline. And this one story that was tragic, neither of us stopped and said, what are the chances that things get lost in FedEx? Like, is it a 0.001, or like, what are the chances? Like, we never stopped to consider the base rate. And this is how we make decisions as humans, is we focus on small sample size stories instead of backing up and saying, okay, what's the base rate, whether in investing or in our real lives?
I love that because I see it all the time in investing, both in terms of upside, one story that somebody got rich buying this one stock or one...
All the time.
One thing. And then on the downside, people give up on an idea because... And I've seen it so many times. I would discuss a stock and then somebody would say, well, but my sister doesn't shop there anymore. Well,
yeah. Yeah.
Somebody is shopping there because they make billions and billions in sales. Somebody is still shopping there. So I don't know about your sister specifically, but I would never know how to properly answer that question. And now after reading your book, it's a sample size.
And really, as you know, having read the book, and thank you, but the book is really about investment mental model. So in the face of uncertainty, how do you make better decisions? And things like paying attention to our storytelling bias, as I call it, or negligence of base rates, another less exciting way to talk about it. But paying attention to the storytelling bias is a mental model. So you know when to pull that out. So like whenever you're being told a story or an instance, you know, to stop and say, what is the sample size? How does this particular story relate to what the broader experience is? And it doesn't mean you don't go with what the story is making you feel, but you have your eyes wide open and you say, you know, we may have still said, we're not going to FedEx the passport. It's still, the risk is too great, but we didn't stop and say, is it worth the downside of not getting it to her as soon in terms of the 0.001 chance that it gets lost?
No,
And another point is, like, I've written a book on this. Like, I've studied this so much. I have a professional certificate from Harvard for in investment decisions and behavioral finance. And I still didn't stop and say, what's the base rate of FedExing a document or a passport?
Stories are very powerful. And speaking of stories, we tell stories about the economy all the time. And you write something. I wrote an article that I called "The Stock Market is Not the Economy." And you write about it in your book, and then you tell a story about the toilet paper and how toilet paper can teach us about investing. I'm curious to hear more about it. But so many times people ask me, should we invest more because the economy is good or bad, or should we not invest because the economy is good or bad? And you make some interesting points about it.
Yeah, so this is probably the most powerful straight-up investing mental model I have in my book of the stock market is not the economy. And if you look at economic growth, so GDP growth, in any given calendar year, and you compare it to what the stock market does, there's no correlation. Since World War II, it's been 0.03. Since my birth, it has been like, you know, 0.05 or something like that. So it's basically zero. And when things are non-correlated, it just means that there's no relationship. You know, if one's, you know, going up, the other may or may not be going up. There's no real relationship. And so what this tells us is that you can't look at what's going on in the economy to tell you what's going on in the stock market. Mm-hmm. But what's fascinating, and this comes out of research from Credit Suisse, which unfortunately is no longer, right? So it's, you know, got subsumed by UBS recently. But so there's this research by Credit Suisse, and what they looked at is looking at last year's or the prior year's stock market returns and then current year GDP. And then the correlations jump. And depending on time period, you know, 0.5, 0.6, 0.7. So what it tells you is that there's a pretty strong positive correlation between what the stock market does in the past and what the economy is doing now. So what that says is that the stock market, what the economy is going to do-ish, like it's not 100%. And again, correlation is just directional. So it doesn't tell you whether the stock, you know, the economy is going to be doing just a little well or very well. But, you know, as an investor, you'd love to have it flipped. You'd love to be able to say, oh, well, it looks like we're heading into a recession. That tells me what the stock market's going to do. Mm-hmm. But it's flipped. Like if the stock market's doing well, it says probably the economy is going to be doing better or at least pretty well in the future. So if you look back to 1930, there were 19 years where the economy or the GDP contracted for the calendar year. So definitely a recession to have a calendar year contraction. And in 12 of those 19 years, the stock market was up, and in all but one instance, up over 18%. So you look at that, you go, wow, that's kind of crazy. You know, how does that happen? And you can just go back to March of 2020 and the stock market bottom, it dropped nearly 35% from its high. The stock market bottom was on March 23rd. And on March 26th is when we had our 1,000th reported COVID death in the US. So like if you and I had a crystal ball and we were sitting there on March 23rd and the crystal ball didn't tell us what the stock market was going to do, but it was tell us what's going to happen in the real world. I said, guess what? This quarter, this coming quarter, GDP is going to contract by 8.9%. Crazy.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's That's breathtaking. Unemployment is going to spike to 14.7%, highest since Great Depression. Mm-hmm. We're going to have over 330,000 deaths in the U.S. by the end of the year, 6 million deaths globally over the next 3 years. And this isn't, well, we're going to like lock down for like a few weeks or months. This is going to go on for years. The NHL and the NBA are going to cancel their seasons. We can't travel internationally, even to Canada, and on and on and on. Like if we knew all those things, like I think most people would be like, I'm going to bury my money in the backyard. But March 23rd was the bottom. Mm-hmm. And it happened in 08, 09. You know, the news was bad and in some respects still getting worse in March 9th, 2009. But we see it over and over again. The stock market moves in advance of the economy, both up and down. But, you know, the Nobel Prize winner, prize-winning economist Paul Samuelson, that the stock market has predicted 9 of the last 5 recessions. So it's not perfect. It's not going to tell you exactly what's going to happen in the economy, but it's a better predictor of the economy than the economy is of the stock market. So the lesson is you cannot take what's going on in the real world of the economy and use it to inform your investment decisions. And people can look at that and go, well, that sucks. And it does. But it's better to know that. And it should be freeing. Like you don't need to know everything that's going on in the economy. You don't need to go to conferences and listen to these investment experts and the economists tell you what's going to happen.
Right.
Kind of like that conference my coworker was just at, where this expert was talking about all these things going on in the economy and, you know, whether we were going to tip into recession or not, but doesn't tell you what the stock market's going to do. So
I love that. You know. I have a big question about predictions, which you just talked about a little bit. And I have this quote from your book that I really like. You said that when humans interact with each other in social systems, extreme outcomes occur that defy prediction. And then you shared two stories of you listening to Alan Greenspan that had some thoughts about the housing market that didn't turn out the way he thought. And then you share a story of a hedge fund manager from New York that you called Tom that was ready to hide and I don't know, build a bunker. Let's talk about predictions, because we spend so much time in trying to figure out what's next, but maybe that's not even relevant in the investment game.
Well, I'll tell you, so Alan Greenspan is pretty interesting, because back in the 90s, in 1996, he said that the stock market was experiencing irrational exuberance, which is a phrase that actually Robert Shiller, the Nobel Prize winning economist, came up with and wrote a book of the same name. But you know, when he said that in 1996, like he was right. Like we were in the midst of the dot-com craze, but you know, the stock market went up by 300%, or the tech heavy NASDAQ went up by 300%, and the stock market more than doubled between 1996 and its market top in March of 2000. So Greenspan was right, but he was way too early. And being early is indistinguishable from being wrong. And then if you flip ahead another 10 years in fall of 2006, I went to an investment conference where he was, you know, fireside chatted up on stage by an economist or investment expert. And he was talking about the subprime market, where people were starting to get concerned about the subprime market. And he said, listen, like, it's only 4% of the mortgage market. It's not that big of a deal. It's not that big of a deal. Even if all 4% went to zero, it's fine, right? Uh-huh. And, you know, I think we're going to see a bit of a, you know, a rough patch here. I don't expect a recession. I don't expect GDP to decline. You will hit a rough patch. And I think in a few quarters, we're going to start seeing, you know, strong economic growth again. And he had just retired from being Fed chair 9 months previous. So he still knew a lot. And, you know, he was, you know, there was a book that Dean wrote about him called The Maestro, because, you know, his deft handling of the economy, he was hailed as the greatest central banker of all time. And he, you know, he did not see the financial crisis coming. And years later, he apologized for missing it and maybe even with his, you know, loose monetary policy contributing to it. But it just shows you, like, if Alan Greenspan, you know, can't get it right. And in both of these instances, he was right, but way too early. And then he was wrong. Absolutely. You know, what about the rest of us? You know, or, you know, what about your, you know, your broker, or even, you know, the chief strategist at the broker that you use, or the guy you hear on CNBC? It's just really telling. And the story of the hedge fund manager is really from 2009. And in 2007, I'd gone to an investment conference, and this guy from this hedge fund had presented. And again, back in 07, like, hedge funds were still like the darling of the investment, like, strategy community. You know, they had, you know, like $4 trillion of assets under management, and were still providing really, really strong risk-adjusted returns. They're, you know, really, you know, respected. And this particular hedge fund that had a few billion under management, you know, it showed his returns and they were fantastic. And this guy was a superstar, you know, Ivy League educated, top MBA, MBA from a top school. And just, he was so impressive. And I talked to him at the, like the cocktail hour, and we had traded cards. So in the, you know, winter, spring of 2009, when everything was just like kind of crashing around us, I was like, I want to talk to this guy, because in the past he has had that crystal ball that I want. Cause again, I still thought that a crystal ball would help back. Yeah. So I had a call with him, and like, I still remember this call and how it made me feel, because he said, yeah, you know, the stock market's down about 50% from its high, right, but things are really just getting started. We think it'll drop another 50% or more. Wow. And I was like, are you kidding me? He's like, mm-hmm. No, this is what's been going on is basically like the appetizer to like a meal, like a four-course meal of misery. He said something like that. It was really poetic. Really good way of words. I was like, are you kidding me? I like, how certain are you? He goes, well, we're nearly 100% sure, because we've moved our entire hedge fund to gold and cash.
Wow.
And he goes, not only that, he goes, I live in New York City. I have bought farmland in New Jersey. And he's like, I have a little cabin there, and I have generators and gas, and I have guns, and I have, you know, all these cans of beans and jugs of water. I have seeds in case I need to actually farm there. You know, and not only that, he goes, I have, you know, $100,000 worth of gold coins in the safe in my apartment in New York in case I need to buy safe passage out with my family. Because gold has always been this medium of exchange, like for all of, you know, civilization. And I was like, are you kidding me? Is it going to be that bad? He goes, oh yeah, yeah. Like, things are just getting started. And I remember, like, when I got off the phone with him, I was about to have a panic attack. Like, I closed off the lights in my office, and I laid there and I did breathing exercises that I'd learned through therapy. And fortunately, you know, I talked to our investment committee about this. And again, fortunately, we were just paralyzed with fear and didn't act on this.
Of course.
And like 3 weeks later, it was the market bottom. And so I always think back to Tom and his prediction and how wrong he was, but also, and I point this out in a footnote, but not in the text of the book, he could have been right. Like, I don't look back and go, oh, well, Tom is like such an idiot. He wasn't an idiot. Like, his prediction for what was going to happen could have happened, but it didn't. Right. And so I say something in my book, you know, kind of actually disparaging, trying to be funny. You know, I think back on Tom of, you know, picture him sitting in a cellar in New Jersey with a shotgun on his lap, you know, eating from eating canned peaches, which I think is funny. Uh-huh. But I really look at him and I have a lot of sympathy, and, you know, how some people make a ton of money and they become stars and they make big bets, and he just was wrong.
Right.
But thank goodness, like, I didn't, like, our firm could be out of business. If I went to all of our clients, it was like, we're moving you to cash and gold, and we would have missed, you know, the bottom and the run up, mm-hmm. you know, we'd probably be out of business. I don't know. I don't know what I would be doing. You know, maybe I'd be a male model. I'm totally kidding.
No, I mean, you know, yeah, it's a,
I'm not that attractive. I'm kidding. I know this is just radio.
but listen, I think, you know, a lot of us in the investment profession took a call or lunch like that at different points in time. And I remember in 2009, and I was, you know, only 4 years into my professional career, 4 or 5 years. And I remember talking to somebody that was a lot older than me, a seasoned investor that has seen it all, and took me to lunch. And he told me he liquidated everything he personally owns, and he's all in cash in March of 2009. And I had a very similar conversation with somebody over the phone in March of 2020 when COVID was happening. And it was also somebody that had many more decades of experience than I do. I'm 42 and I've been in the business 18 years. So I've seen some things. I don't think I've seen it all. I've seen a lot. But he told me he did exactly the same, different person, same story, you know, went all cash in March of 2020, because he said he doesn't want to wait another 10 years to recoup the losses.
Yeah.
And, you know,
And the stock market was up 70% between then and the end of the year. And I'll tell you, like, the important thing, like, this mental model, the stock market's not the economy, and not listening to predictions is so important, because in 08, 09, I didn't know how to advise my clients. I was paralyzed with fear. Mm-hmm. In 2020, we knew how to advise our clients. In fact, on March 26, 3 days after the market bottom, I published an article in Forbes saying, even though a severe recession is looming, it doesn't mean you should sell out of the stock market. That was the title of it. And it's not that I was able to call the bottom. I had no idea. But it was the advice we gave to our clients, which is, do not sell out of the stock market. Just because things are bad and getting worse, it does not tell you what the stock market's going to do. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of our clients, we actually rebalanced. We sold bonds, bought stocks. Again, not because we called the bottom. It's just what our discipline said to do. But we confidently said, we don't know. And here's what you should do.
Mm-hmm.
Versus confidently, we know what's going to happen. And here's what you can do. You're going to do. And we would have been wrong, you know, because there's no way we could have predicted what actually happened. Like, we were not predicting there was going to be, you know, millions of COVID deaths and it was going to go on as long as it did.
Right.
And even if we did, it wouldn't have told us what the stock market's going to do.
Exactly. I think that's the biggest lesson. John, real quick, you share 8 best practices that I'd like to go over real quick. You talk about inactivity, simplicity, need for an investment policy, margin of safety, focus on the long term, don't look at your portfolio, have a play account, and find the right advisor.
Yeah.
I think they should be somewhere, you know, on a gold plated framed.
Yeah. So it really kind of summarizes the concept that behavior is the most important factor in successful investing. It's not finding the right stock. I mean, if you go all in one stock, like in, you know, 1996, you go all into Apple and that's all you've owned. Yeah, that's awesome. You were successful, but
of course,
you know, few if anybody's going to do that. So it's really about having the right behavior. And I'll tell you, like, when it comes to investment wisdom or wisdom in most things in life, you can tell something is wise
mm-hmm.
if it's simple, but often not easy, right? Like, you're going to have better health if you exercise regularly and eat your vegetables, right? That is not sexy and as fun as, you know, there's this device that you can strap to your waist that's, you know, going to jiggle you that you don't have to do any work. You're going to be fit. Or, you know, here's this, you know, crazy, you know, soup and grapefruit diet or something that's, you're going to lose, you know, 50 pounds in a month. So things that are wise are simple, but not easy. And they're often not like really exciting. And, and something that, you know, we worry about when we're with new clients is, you know, we don't tell them a lot of things that sound super exciting. We're like, have a margin of safety, have enough cash that you can have good behavior. And that varies by person. But if you're withdrawing from your portfolio regularly, we say, have a year of withdrawals in cash.
Right.
And have another few years in, you know, shorter term, high quality bonds. You know, have enough bonds in total. Yeah, they're going to be a drag on performance. But if they help you behave better, you know, maybe you can take, you know, this higher risk, handle this more volatility in other areas, if you have enough of a margin of safety. And yeah, be inactive. In general, don't do anything to your portfolio. Don't look at your portfolio. If you feel like you need to tinker, have a play account. And we have a lot of clients that do this. I do this personally. Is you know, I have an account where I buy thematic ETFs, and every once in a while I buy a stock, you know, individual stock, and you know, it's done horrible. You know, it just is this great reminder that, you know, I'm not going to be able to, you know, outguess or outpredict. But we have clients that do that too. You know, and if they have a $50 million portfolio, yeah, maybe it's $100,000, $500,000, maybe it's even $1 million of this play account. But if they can, you know, sow their oats with a smaller, you know, portfolio that will keep them doing the incredibly boring, inactive discipline things in their main portfolio, then they end up being successful, you know, over the long term. So yeah, a lot of these best practices, again, they're not like sexy, but they're simple and they're not always easy. It's not easy to be inactive in the face of the market volatility. It's not easy to choose simplicity over complexity, especially when that's what the financial services industry is trying to sell you.
No, I love that. And I like that idea of not looking at the portfolio and having a play account. I think between the two, I think you can make a big difference, because if you have some ideas and client wants to do things, let's keep it in a play account. John, one last question. Definition of success.
Yeah.
I'm very curious about how you think about it.
So I have a few. My favorite and kind of funny one, but there's some truth to it, is the definition of success, that you are successful if you have the ability to organize your day around a nap. And really what that's saying is that you have control somewhat over your life, which I think is really what a lot of us want. And obviously that's not an all-encompassing definition of success. Like, this weekend I hung out with a friend of mine who's a surgeon. Like, he cannot like take a nap every day. He's a surgeon and he's obviously, you know, loves what he does and is, you know, positively affecting humanity. So that's not really the definition of success, but it's one of the ones I pay attention to. You know, how much control do I have over my life? And then really the second one is that success isn't something you get to. It's, you know, this process. You know, are you
right.
you know, it's really, you know, are you enjoying what you're doing? Are you excited to get up every day or most days? You know, are you making, do you feel good about the impact you're making on other people and, you know, the community and the, and the planet? You know, I think especially, you know, working with families that our average family has $200 and something million. So I've had this incredible career where I've been able to advise families that are just, you know, incredibly wealthy. And, you know, I've seen what really makes them happy or gives them purpose when they don't, you know, it's not the pursuit of money. And it, you know, I think there's a lot to learn from that. Like what would you do if you had all the money you ever needed? Like what would your life look like? And I think it can teach the rest of us that we don't need to be chasing, you know, money. That's not really a source of success and happiness. And we all know this. Like we all know this, but again, it's simple, but it's not easy to do. And in fact, my next book is currently called, I'm in the process of writing it, but it's called How to Be Wealthy. And it's not mm-hmm. how to get wealthy, but once you're wealthy, and again, you don't have to mm-hmm. have tens of millions to be wealthy. I get into various definitions of wealthy, but once you're wealthy, how do you do it well? How do you have purpose and happiness? How do you not ruin your kids? How do you, you know, use your money to choose a good quest and to make a productive dent in the universe, right? So those are topics I'm very interested in, and it's all wrapped up in, you know, what is success? But it's also, can you take a nap?
I love the nap part. And the last few years of COVID, I had more naps than ever before.
Wasn't it great?
It was great. But it's also, you know, the walk in the middle of the day and the ability to break up your day into pieces. I think the topic you're writing about, I love it. And I'm very curious to read that book when it comes out and have you back and talk about it. John, you were so generous today with your wisdom and your time. So I greatly enjoyed it.
Yeah.
John, thank you so much for today. Yeah. I learned a lot. I really appreciate your time. And I'm looking forward to reading the next book. I think it's a very exciting project. So thank
you. Yeah, as I've been on podcasts and radio shows and I talk about the next book, people are like, okay, I liked your first book, but I want to read that next book. So
that's a good sign for an author. I think that's a very good sign. I think your book, Uncertainty, it's just a remarkable resource. And we just really touched on a selected number of ideas, but there's so much research and studies that you included. And I think it's a remarkable book for anybody curious about professional investing and even a family looking at finding an advisor. What does it really take to find the right advisor? I think it's an incredible read.
Yeah. Well, and let me give you one more. Let me shout out my personal website, which is johnmjennings.com, johnmjennings.com. And you can find out more about my book and me, but also there's my blog there, which is called The Interesting Fact of the Day. So up in the menu, there's the IFOD. Mm-hmm. And I just write on random interesting things. None of them are financial or rarely financial. Like today's is on, you know, I've owned an electric vehicle for a year. It's what I've determined the economics of owning an EV are. Friday, I published one on why aren't planes getting any faster? So just random, hopefully interesting thing. So would love to have new subscribers to that.
I'm going to include links to both your website and that newsletter, the blog as well, so people can look it up in the notes to this episode.
Great. Well, thanks. Thank you so much for having me on. This was super fun.
Super fun. Thank you so much, John. Bye.
You were listening to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment and follow, subscribe, rate, and share with friends and family. We rely on word of mouth to promote the show. One click for you means the world to us. Thank you. Until next time, your host, Bogumil Baranowski. The content of this podcast is for general informational purposes only, and so are the opinions of members of Sicard Associates, a registered investment advisor, and guests of the show. This podcast does not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any specific security or financial instruments, or provide investment advice or service. Past performance is not indicative of future results. More information on Sicard Associates is available in its Form ADV disclosure documents available at advisorinfo.sec.gov.